call the committee to order. And Alex, we'll start with the roll call.
Representative Chairman Nelson.
Here.
Holman.
Here.
Schobinger.
Here.
Senators Wanzek.
Here.
Elkin.
Here.
Matherin.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, you have a quorum.
Thank you, Alex. I'd also like to welcome Representative Carla Rose Hansen and Representative Rohr from Legislative Management, who are with us today. We're glad to have you, and feel free to take part in the questions if you have some. We're very happy to have you here. Okay, next on the agenda is the consideration of minutes. Everybody had a chance to review them. Moved by Holman, seconded by Wanzek. Any questions? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. Okay, let's go to the 10.05 agenda item, the presentation by Department of Corrections, updating the DOCR study by the MOS Group. Mr. Krabanoff.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
You're a long ways away.
Right, yeah. A lot of room here. Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Krabanoff, Director of Administration for the DOCR. And I handed out two things for you. One, I've got my bullet points we're going to talk about, and then I also handed out our strategic plan that we just updated and went through. So really this is for, you know, your purpose is to look through. I won't go through and read it, but we have updated it, and we're feeling pretty good about it. It's got, you know, who we are and then our goals and objectives about what we're doing. And it ties in, I wanted to hand that out because it ties in directly from what we've asked the MOS Group to do as well. So they're aware of these changes, and we talked about it when they were on site last time. But to just give you a quick update on where the MOS Group is, or where they're at in the process, I should say. Back in November, they were on site. They had three folks on site, two or three folks, and they did a physical plan assessment of the State Penitentiary, Jamestown, James River Correctional Center, Youth Correctional Center. They went out to DWCRC in New England and toured that facility, and then they also went to the state hospital and looked at some specific buildings there. They didn't do the whole campus, but just the buildings that we pointed out that have typically been always a topic of discussion when we go through, like those administrative buildings there. One is empty and the one holds the offices of the hospital. They went through there. They went through the La Hogue building. They went through the JRMRU building, which is our building now, which is a formerly TRCC. And so they gathered some information there, and they're working on physical plan assessments. They gave us some brief results of that when they were in town on February, the beginning of February. But that they're using that information to compile additional information and give us feedback on those buildings and how they all fit in, not only the physical, you know, if the roof is still good and the windows work, but also how the layout and how that would work with our vision and mission of the Department of Corrections. So that's a component of the report that we're excited to see. MOS Group and Carter CGL, which partnered with the MOS Group on this, they were on site February 3rd through the 5th. With that, we started out with some visioning sessions, which focused on our strategic plan as well. We had invited numerous parties throughout. We thought about the committee itself, but Alex reminded us that we can only have so many, otherwise we'd have a quorum and then we'd have a public meeting. And so we invited a couple folks from the committee. I don't know if I think the schedule is conflicted, so we weren't able to do that. But we had DOCR staff obviously there. We had state and local partners there as well. So we had, for instance, our BTC folks and Center Incorporated. New England was there. DWCR Rochelle was there at that first visioning meeting. We had some of our community partners. We had advocacy groups there, and we also had some clergy there. And we were all sitting down about what the DOCR is and what we should be doing and the vision that we should be leading. And we had some real productive discussions there, two sessions that we had with that. And then they conducted six workshops. And the workshops were focused on restorative justice, conditions of confinement, prisoner profile and risk needs assessment, programs and services on the adult side. And then the juvenile, we had resident profile, risk and needs, and then programs and services. We did the juvenile sessions over at YCC, and the adult sessions were at the DOCR central office. I thought they were informative and productive. They took a lot of information back. And right now what they're doing is, when we touched base with them last week, they're coming up with, under what I have next steps, is draft options, a paper from the visioning and workshop sessions. And then also they're going to share their results on resident population projections on both the adult and the juvenile going forward. So we look forward to that, what's coming up. Obviously, they've got a lot of information now, and they're in the process of compiling that and putting it in a report that we'll hopefully have this July or August that we'll be able to share with that. So I really thought the sessions were productive and helpful in going on, and we wanted to get as many people there as we could, and obviously conflicts and calendars and all that kind of stuff affected it. But for instance, we had ministry on the margins there. We had a representative from the ACLU there. Like I said, we had our contract partners, DWCRC, Center Incorporated, BTC, were there, and council, Alex attended, OMB attended. So we had a pretty good representative cross-cut, what we thought was provided some really good insight on what the expectations are and how DLCR should look to the future. So we're excited to see that report kind of starting to take form. So that's all I had. Any questions?
We'll open up for questions. Senator Mathern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Kravnoff, I'm wondering, in these groups, did you have anybody representing indigenous people?
Yes.
Tribal organizations?
Yeah. Who, Mr. was Chairman? Lorraine Davis was there. She attended a couple sessions with us. I should have mentioned them on the list.
Who
apologize
did she represent? Was it an organization or
it was
generally?
The Native American.
Native American Development Center.
Yeah, Leanne, like that. It was the Development Center, Native American Development Center.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Sorry about that.
I believe she's got a nonprofit that she's involved with as well. I guess I'd just like to drill down a little bit more on when you were out in New England, you said that DWCRC was at the table. You know, they were at the table and had input as to the discussion. They were engaged in that, because you know that's a very sensitive issue. You know, in the last session and going forward, we want that their opinion to be to be part of this study, and that they're fully engaged is
right.
I'm assuming that that's the case,
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, we had Rochelle was at the very first visioning session that we had. She participated in that, and they also were on site. They went out with their folks, and I don't know exact dates that they were at DWCRC, but no, we understand that, and that's why we made sure they were included on that visioning session at the beginning.
Okay, and they may have.
They'd have
the opportunity to speak to that if they choose to. But
yep.
I'm glad to hear that, because we want everybody that's affected, you know, or currently working with in the corrections community to to have full input in this next process.
Totally agree.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, you can proceed.
Okay, I'm done.
Oh, you're done. Sure,
yeah.
Right.
Now Lisa is going to come up if I'm done.
Okay. Make sure the mic is set for her. We don't want to miss a word.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
So I have a handout for you. It's not very complicated, so I just thought what we would do is you guys get to hear. Particularly those of you from appropriations get to hear a lot about sort of the inner workings of what we do in the Division of Juvenile Services. But the topic that I was asked to talk about today is juvenile justice reform. So I thought I would take you through some of the things that the policy people have been doing that interface with what we do within the division. And so there were a few things that happened last session that I'm just so excited about, because they really start moving us towards taking a really good look at what's going on with kids, and considering it's always important to remember that the way our code is currently set up, juvenile justice includes child welfare, because of the chapter that talks about what happens to abused and neglected kids is in the juvenile code. And so when we start talking about what we can, opportunities that we have to strengthen things, divert more kids and do things better, it includes what we do in juvenile justice along with our interface and partners with the child welfare system. So in the last session, there was created a cabinet that has two arms of work. One arm is to set up a continuum of behavioral health services for children, and the other arm is a juvenile justice commission that is charged specifically with looking at Chapter 2720, which is the Juvenile Court Act. In addition to that, there were a handful of other policy bills, one that raised the age of delinquency from age 7 to age 10, and one that created, most specifically to juvenile justice, a detention screening tool that went into effect on the 1st of August. And so I want to talk with you a little bit about the impacts of all of those things on what we've been doing. In addition, the Interim Judiciary Committee is also chosen to study juvenile justice. And so we have a couple of members of that committee that are working all the way across. So we have people that work on the Interim Judiciary Committee that are also on the Juvenile Justice Commission and are working on the Children's Cabinet. So there's some real nice continuity in terms of people covering the waterfront and legislators knowing what's happening all across the work. So the Interim Judiciary Committee and the Juvenile Justice Commission really wanted to make sure that we work hand in hand, since the Interim Judiciary Committee wants to take a close look at 2720 as well, since that is also the work specifically of the Juvenile Justice Commission. We've been trying to line that work up so it goes forward together and enhances each other's work rather than stumble over each other or kind of try to take on the same things. And so one of the things that Chair Clamine did early on was approach the Juvenile Justice State Advisory Group to ask if there might be some dollars available that we could put together to get the Council of State Governments in to help us take a look at our system and maybe propose some things that we should be working on. And so we were real busy this summer with the Juvenile Justice State Advisory Group. We developed a process for proposals. We screened applications. We selected the CSG was the applicant that was selected out of that whole process. And that entity has then been working with the Interim Judiciary Committee and the Juvenile Justice Commission and the State Advisory Group to start giving us sort of a roadmap, kind of a place to start. What do they think the best points to begin might be, and what they've already got a couple of themes that they think are clear things that we should be working on, and I'm going to get into that a little bit for you today as well. And some of you have been attending some of those other meetings and are kind of up to speed on all of that. So we had the CSG people here earlier this month, and they gave us a very interesting presentation on their work across the country. And what I want to say about this, the reason that I think that the research that they did in Texas is so important to us is not because we're just like Texas, because clearly we're not, but when you are really going to try to do some robust and meaningful research, you have to have enough of a sample size to be able to draw some conclusions. And so what they were able to do in Texas involved them being able to access about almost a million, it was like 889,000, almost 900,000 juvenile records. And so with a sample size that large, they were able to match cohorts of kids so that they would have a group of kids that looked very similar racially and risk-wise and age-wise, and they matched these cohorts and then followed them. And so they were able to really draw some conclusions that we hadn't had in juvenile justice up until that very large study was done. That study was completed in 2015. and published. And so we have been working here, and you guys who have to put up with me in appropriations have heard about this for the last like three bienniums, what we've been trying to do to implement those kinds of reforms that might lead us down some of those better paths for how we manage those deep end juvenile justice kids. So I thought I would take some of their slides and sort of show you the bones of what they found, and then talk a little bit about where we're at with some of that stuff. Because although we've been doing some work within juvenile corrections since 2015, it's now time to really make sure that the systems around us have been strengthened and prepared to also do the work that they need to do to both keep kids out of prison when they don't need to be, but also to just provide better, prepare better outcomes for kids. And so now I'm going to try to click the clicker.
Lisa, before you do,
yes.
Help
anything
me.
Anything to avoid clicking this.
Okay. If my memory serves me right, CSG was contracted to with the Justice Reinvestment Project in a previous biennium, and I guess I'm curious, were they able to leverage some of the findings that they were able to discover during that process, you know, going forward for the juvenile system, or is this basically starting from scratch with this contract?
So CSG, Mr. Chairman, CSG has been here before. They were involved in your work on adult reform.
Right.
But they were also involved in 2015 in North Dakota. And so they're able to move forward from that work, but not necessarily are there parallels to the work that they did when you were doing your adult reform work.
Okay, so this is a different division and different individuals
It is different individuals. Yes. So in 2015, as part of that money that CSG had to do all of that research that they did in several areas, I'm going to focus on Texas because that's what they based their closer to home project on, and that's what they're sort of bringing here for us to take a look at. But they had, I don't know what all their funding sources were, but one of their funding sources provided for a 50-state convening where a select group of, they named the positions of the juvenile justice people in each state convened, and this is where they unveiled most of this research. And then what they did is they offered seven states, they had enough money to offer seven states the opportunity to do a very similar kind of deep dive into their system and make a lot of changes. We applied to be one of those seven states and kind of did a little letter writing campaign, and were very encouraging. They decided to come out and do a site visit because they were having trouble deciding which seven states to pick, and so we were kind of in the finalists. And they did several days of meetings with stakeholders from all three branches of government, as well as some of the private providers, schools, and other people who, law enforcement, those people who interact with juvenile justice. In the end, they recommended that We probably didn't require the full, they didn't think it would be worth the investment of the full deep dive at that point in time. But they did very strongly recommend, there were about 15 things on their list, some of them more important than others, but key in that was the dual status youth project. And you've heard me talk about dual status youth, and some of the rest of you have been involved in some of that work. And so we took that very to heart, and there were four partners that really got together and made sure that we engaged with the dual status work in exactly the way it was intended. And so that was the Supreme Court, Child and Family Services in the Department of Human Services, the Juvenile Justice State Advisory Group, and then the Division of Juvenile Services. And so we pooled enough money together to get them here, the people that do the dual status youth work. It was the Robert F. Kennedy Foundation. And we've worked now for 3 years in the dual status youth arena. That work now is just being handed off to the Court Improvement Project to be sustained. Dual status youth is the point in time at which a child welfare youth, a neglected or maltreated youth, has their first encounter with the juvenile justice system. And so the intent of the work is to find ways to improve conditions for those kids who have been maltreated or abused so that they don't now have to enter a second system. We have a lot of kids that the pathway into juvenile probation and juvenile court and then all the way through to us is that start out in child welfare, particularly for the kids. The two particular pathways are those maltreated kids who are placed in the residential environments and don't do well and become physically disruptive. Those kids tend to get charged with assaults or disorderly conducts, and they move pretty quickly into corrections, and they get much worse once they're with us. The other place where we have, and we've talked about this a lot in our Appropriations Committee, but the other place where kids tend to move from that abused sort of mental health, maltreated arena into juvenile justice is in the schools when they're very, very disruptive and they end up incurring some sort of legal charge while they're in the school. So the Dual Status Youth Project is really around strengthening the front end of the system so that those child welfare kids get the services they need and do not need to move forward, whether that's through the child welfare service arm or whether we do something else with prevention and then the behavioral health services that we offer in schools. So you can see how that all kind of ties back up to that cabinet who's going to have a very important role in kind of keeping all of this stuff straight. So they have that opportunity to build that continuum of behavioral health services, and they're working real hard on that. And then we have the Juvenile Justice Commission, who is to look at how our code works and does it work the way we intended it to, and what should our public policy be around delinquency, maltreatment, and abuse. And then the third piece is that interim committee. I know it's like a lot and it's all sort of a Gordian knot, but does that kind of, did I find a way to make it make sense? I hope.
For those of us that are in appropriations, it makes perfect sense. I don't know if that's scary or not.
I'm going to click the clicker and see if the slide moves. It did. So one of the slides that the CHG used was, and I've talked to you guys quite a bit about this before, that incarceration rates for kids are declining significantly over the last decade. Actually, they've declined a lot longer than one decade, but this is as long as this particular slide's goes back. So, Senator Elkin, you saw this slide at CSG, but you didn't see the North Dakota number on here. And so I'm not exactly sure what all CSG stuck in their nationwide definition. So I think it may include some kids that are in residential, like ranch settings in other states, but I'm not certain on that, so I just want to disclaim that a little bit. But I do know what is in our 69%, and that is the kids that are coming into youth corrections as well as the kids that are being detained. So you can see that we've been working right along with the rest of the country to put kids in more appropriate environments. You know, it made sense to do what we do with these large sort of centralized institutions, but that's sort of model of isolate and warehouse, we just know now that there are significant harms that come with that model across all systems. And so that's really why you're hearing so much about that as the policymakers in our business and in behavioral health and in all kinds of venues where we've concentrated services in one area, because it's hard to spread them out and do it effectively. And so the publication that came out of the research then is the Closer to Home. And if any of you are really, really interested in that, I can get it to you. It's available electronically, and you can just look for it yourselves, too. It's on the Justice Center site. But this was the research that I talked about where they looked at probably about 1 million cases, and they created these cohorts of similar type kids, so kids that were similar in risk level, similar in history. And the sort of the flagpole moment when we all looked at this 5 or 6 years ago was that kids that had been incapacitated in secure state-run facilities had a much higher probability of arrest than kids that were supervised and treated in the community. And that is irregardless of risk level, okay? And that's the important thing about this, is that even for those high-risk kids, even for those kids with lots of needs, the ones that were supervised and managed and treated in the community where there were lots of community-based services did much better 1 year out. The thing about recidivism rates is, for kids, they kind of amplify over time, right? Because 1 year out still has not gotten you to that age 24 or 25 when you finally have a frontal lobe and the crime starts to drop. So if you look at kids' recidivism over time, it tends to get worse for a while before it gets better. So this was a real, I think, dire kind of wake-up call for that whole model that we have of, let's put really good services into our institution and then bring the kids there for care. Because what we see is, there's lots of research still going on, but a big piece of this is contagion. And so you put bad kids together and we make them be good, but they talk about all the bad things, and pretty soon you have them kind of catching being bad from each other. The next slide. So yeah, so they're 21%. The next slide here, this is the one I really want to spend some time on. Even worse than the fact that they recidivate more is that they tend to recidivate with a felony. So they tend to recidivate, now this is Texas, but they recidivated with a felony, not just skinning their knees someplace on the sidewalk. They were pretty serious. And again, not only did the kids that were treated in the community do better, but fewer of them, when they had a problem, had a serious problem. And so if you're looking at this from a just what's best for kids perspective, or if you're looking at this from a how do we make the best use of our dollars, there's a pretty strong, bright, you know, blinking light that starts to focus you on what are you doing in the community, and what are you doing to have services that you can wrap around kids and families. Because clearly, we're not making people better, despite our best efforts and wonderful people who do a great job and have a heart for kids and are doing everything they possibly can to make kids' lives better. It doesn't make them better to put them in the institution. So the only kids we want to have there are the kids that we're absolutely certain we can't safely serve any place out there at that high risk. So.
Representative Rohr.
Thank you, Chairman. So, Lisa, my question is, how are you defining community supervision? And is that the area that we're working on then here in North Dakota to enhance that?
Representative Rohr and Chairman. So the Division of Juvenile Services primarily defines itself as a case management system. And so we have really intensively trained, really, really good case managers who, in fact, I don't even like to call them case managers, because then they get compared to case managers in other disciplines, and these are like Navy SEAL case managers. I mean, they're just on it. They have small caseloads. They're in those homes. They're following those kids around. We have case aides that can help us, you know, kind of track them down, do some surveillance work, that kind of thing. Surveillance, oddly enough, is not a bad word in juvenile justice. Kids where you want to keep a close eye on the wrong kid, because every normal kid does some things you shouldn't see, or you'll make them worse, right? I mean, I bet there were some things, well, maybe not you, Representative Nelson, but some of the rest of us did things that it was a good thing our mom and dad didn't know about.
That is a good point.
May I continue?
You may continue.
So you mentioned Navy SEAL, but what are the true credentials of these individuals?
So the bottom for hiring is a bachelor's degree plus 2 years of experience working directly with the treatment needs of kids, and then we train them.
Lisa, if I could, when you compare the Texas example to North Dakota, you know, are the wraparound services, in your opinion, do we have those services that can meet the needs in the community. And, you know, and then when we get into North Dakota, we have a divide between, you know, the rural areas of the state and the not the, the less rural areas. Are there enough professionals to provide those services?
So the short and honest answer is no. But there are, we have a tension on this now like we never have. And there are some areas that are very hopeful. And you hear me talking all the time about intensive in-home services
right.
that you fund through our appropriation committee and our day treatment services, and we know those work. There are other additional behavioral health services, though, that are beginning to emerge. And so I'm going to get to the last part of that answer in a minute.
Okay.
But to finish answering your question, so we have these great case managers, and they're working with those families, but without services for those kids, it's really hard not to start relying back on the residentials.
Senator Elkin?
Lisa, are you talking about psychologists then? Or what are you referencing to as far as a degree in behavior?
Sure. You know, they're nothing against psychologists. Those are great people, and we could sure use more of them, but you all know we don't have those. And so what we're real big fans of is we know that cognitive behavioral interventions are the most, have the best chance of success with people who are making antisocial decisions. That is sort of the family of interventions that is the most effective. And not all of those have to be delivered by PhD level people. And so we use a model of substance abuse that is focused on cognitive behavioral interventions that bachelor's degree people can do. And we have other cognitive intervention programs that bachelor's degree people can deliver. They're very effective. Our intensive in-home model is run by one of the private providers, and that's a model where we send, the therapist goes to the family. So those are, they're tough jobs to keep filled because that's late afternoons, evenings, weekends. It's working when families are together in their home. But it's service that's provided in the home. I'm such a big fan of it because when you're in that home, you're not just working with a youth then. You've got, if you're strengthening the capacity of mom and dad or mom or dad or whatever the combination, grandma, whatever it is, you're also making a positive impact on the other kids in that home.
If I could be before, I call on you, Representative Rohr. I would just remind the committee members to key your mic when you ask a question for the public record so the Alex can pick all that up. Representative Rohr.
Thank you, Chairman. So just so I'm clear, it's either a BS in psychology or a BS in criminal justice. And then you mentioned that there's additional training that you guys do to these with these people to become, you know, case managers. So what does that involve?
So we also have a bunch of people who are social workers. So the bachelor's degrees might be in social work, they might be in criminal justice, they might be, as you said, in psychology. I have a couple of really good case managers that are political science majors. See, I thought you'd be impressed by that. But
no farmers, I'm assuming there's no farmers.
Is there a degree? I would love an ag degree. You know, some of the people who make the best case managers are people who have a background in DD, because the developmental disabilities people understand that if you're going to change behavior, you have to be able to break it down into little tiny pieces and kind of track it and plan it. And I mean, so they come very well prepared. And so we train twice a year all together, but then we're sending our people to training, like when the Child and Family Services Division has their conference, we're there. Last week was the ICWA conference, which is the Indian Child Welfare Act conference, and we had staff there, and then they bring back for us. We attend any of the mental health, the behavioral health, the kinds of conferences that the Department of Human Services puts on. We have our own models, of course. I mean, we have a very sophisticated risk and needs assessment. We have a couple of week assessment process at the beginning of every case where we do a real deep dive into data gathering and then the assessment, the risk instruments and the needs instruments that we can deliver. One you may be familiar with that is part of the assessment process is the CANS, which is the Child and Adolescent Needs survey, and that's one that's pretty widely used. We like to use those things that other partners use as well, so that we have points where we can speak the same language. So in that initial stage of a case, then there's a really good treatment plan developed, and then it's monitored and followed. And as we're getting close to the end of the court order, we're making decisions on progress and whether or not we have to go back to court and ask the judge for an extension, or whether we think we've been able to accomplish the intention of the court order in the duration we're originally given. In any time you'd like to come and see what case management looks like, just give me a holler and...
You may continue.
My only concern is that rural aspect that the chair brought up. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there a subcommittee working specifically on what kind of resources are needed and how that should look?
So case management is statewide. So if you're in Flaxton, you can have a case manager. The services, though, as you said, are not there yet. I'm very hopeful that with the recommendations that come from the interim, the commission, and the cabinet, that we'll be able to do some things around behavioral health services for kids in the next session. And I'm hopeful that there'll be a lot more clarity around what that menu of services might look like. There's also a group of people working on multi-tiered systems of support for schools, and I think there'll be some good recommendations coming from there as well. But I really wanted, you know, to sort of show you, because they're going to be back here again. They're coming back in April, the Council of State Government people. And I think what you will see is someone, whether it will be that interim judiciary committee or the Juvenile Justice Commission, maybe even the cabinet, is going to make a move to say, look, we have taken to heart your first recommendations, but we would now like to consider doing that deeper dive and looking at juvenile justice reform. So you may hear more about that as we move towards session. So we've been able to keep that population that is in the facility around 50 now for a couple of years. And we think that there's about 20 kids in that 50 that are very serious, very dangerous delinquent kids that probably are always going to need some kind of fairly secure care. There's another probably 10 of those kids that are incredibly high-risk drug abusers that the systems that work around us have just not been able to find any way to get in the way of what is developing as a very serious addiction. Then there's about 20 kids that are still those dual status youth kids that have come in because of their failures in the child welfare system and because we haven't had the sufficient kind of support. And man, there are some rascals. I mean, those kids are up to a lot of behavior all day, every day. But they're not the kind of public safety kids that should be in corrections. And these are the kids that keep me up at night because they're the ones we're making worse. And we've got a lot of kids out of there that shouldn't have been there, but we still have this last piece that we have to really work hard on getting out of there. But it's going to be really hard to do that until we have the kind of services in the community. And frankly, for these kids, they're far enough distraught so that probably how we're going to be able to attack that is when we get that front door closed better so that there's better services for kids earlier on. We'll just see those trickle out by attrition. So we've been working hard on this. I show you my recidivism rates. We talk about this every 2 years. It varies from a low of about 10 to a high of, I think one year it was almost 20, wasn't it? 20. So last year was 16. So when the kids come to us, we're pretty good at stopping them from moving on into the adult system. So our overall rate of recidivism for the last cohort, and we measure it a year, like these guys did, a year after they're out, the overall rate was 16. But the kids that came out of YCC, now this is a sorting issue, because this is one of those things that when this gets quoted wrong is going to, but I want to tell you this because it's important. The kids that came out of YCC recidivated at a rate of 93%.
Wow.
What this means, I think, and it's going to take us a couple more years to know this, this means we're keeping the right kids there. When I tell you I got 20 kids that are going to be the ones that are moving on into the adult system, we got the right ones in. And I think that probably bears out, you, just in your communities, you know you're not hearing about kids on DJS committing awful crimes. So it anecdotally makes sense to me, as well as what we tried to do with the system. But when you have that population of kids in, it's so important that you do not have kids that can be made worse. And so again, the focus has got to be on those kids that came in through that other channel, kind of that schools, residential, misbehavior, they're assaultive, they're substance abusing. If we can do things with those kids to just kind of support them, those are the kids that the research says, if you can prevent them from developing some sort of lifelong impact, like an addiction that they can't get away from, or starting their family too young, if you can get them through a few years, they'll taper off, they'll go away, they'll do fine. But we should not have those kids in juvenile corrections, because it's just not good for them.
Lisa, what's your census at the YCC now?
50 this morning. Okay. Yeah, so that's 40 boys, 41 boys, but there's 9 girls. And I'm not a big fan of girls in a correctional setting. It's not a good place for them. Not because it's a bad place, it's a great place. The staff care for those kids like you would not believe. But that isn't how you make kids better. And that's, like I said, the honest, cold, hard truth. It's a lot easier just to look at the overall success, which means, but like I said, I think what that means is we're sorting those kids very well. And by the way, it's 14 when I'm talking about the recidivists. There were 14 of them. So it isn't like we're not talking here a prison full, right? But they're very serious kids who are going to go on to have further problems. They're very delinquent. So, anything else on that?
Well, I'm glad that you explained that as thoroughly as you did, because you know the easy takeaway would be that what we're doing isn't working. You know when you look at those numbers, and you know I think it's interesting how in your explanation that.
Well, I mean, look at the supervised in the community, because that's where the rest of the kids are, right?
Right.
And our recidivism rate last year was even better than that, and some years is even better than that. It's down around 10%. So I think what the takeaway is, and maybe I should have just explicitly said it, I think the case management system is doing a really terrific job. I think it's doing exactly what you guys intend it to. I think that those community-based treatment programs, the in-home, the day treatment, they're doing exactly what they're supposed to do. I think we've managed to get down now to where we're housing the kids that better be in, because if they're not in, they're going to be causing trouble in whatever community they're in. So I think there's a lot of really good news in what I just told you. It isn't that the services at YCC are lacking. It's that these are kids that are, every kid's going to leave the juvenile justice system, right? They're not doing life sentences. Most of them are going to leave within a year. And a year is not a sufficient amount of time to really have rehabilitated what amounts to the first 17 years of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I have a research article on my desk that says if you haven't intervened by age 8, what you're doing after that is going to get harder and harder. So by the time we get them when they're 17, that's 10 more years.
Senator Mather.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Lisa, would you have a number to approximate the cost, let's say the per year cost of these 14, what does that cost compares to another 14 that are in the community? I mean, where somebody is being supervised in the community and they are receiving the services that they need in the community. Do we have a cost comparison of that? I would imagine that must also be costly in the community if they're really getting all the services.
Senator Mathern and Representative Nelson, the thing is, I can tell you for the services that we provide, but trying to get into like figuring out what it costs for the services they get through the Department of Human Services or the services that they might get through a private provider, I really haven't had the resources to do that kind of a look, but it's probably worth doing. I know what it costs us to supervise kids in the community. Now I'm going to say that like a big shot, and I can't remember. Michelle, do you remember when we figured it out what it was? It was last year during session, but I mean, it's this much, and a cost of a day at the correctional center is this much. But I
and that
I
smaller
think
amount,
point.
The smaller amount, the community service, does that include the
no, just the
service, it just includes your
management.
Supervision of
yeah.
that process,
yeah.
not the content of the treatment
yeah.
they're getting. Gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, we probably should.
Here's
it's kind of like my trip down this morning. You know, I'm running behind, and I either drive faster and break the law, or I find a shorter route, and there is no shorter route, so we better move this.
Would you like me to just shut up, or should I just go fast?
Well, it's you know, believe it or not, this isn't the bring a lot of questions with your presentation. So you know,
that doesn't mean I'm questionable, does it?
No.
Okay, good. All right, I'll go fast then. So what I wanted to, we stuck this slide in, Lisa, I keep looking at Lisa Johnner because she and I put this stuff together. We stuck this in because of that bill last year that mandated now that there be a detention screening tool so that when law enforcement and courts are looking at kids going into detention, they're actually using an instrument to rate whether they should be there or not. I don't have the data from across the state, but I do provide detention services in this region. We contract with counties in the southwest side of the state for detention services. And from the time the law went into effect on the 1st of August until the 15th of January of this year, there had been 41 placements. And I think it's important to note that 42% of those kids did not have a high enough score on the instrument to warrant detention. This is going to be a cultural thing we're going to have to change. This is something that is going to cause waves with law enforcement and with the courts. And I think it ties to our previous conversation and in some of the recommendations CSG is going to make. I think it would be a lot easier to change this culture if people out there that encounter kids had other resources that they could use other than citing the kid and bringing them into detention. So I think this is just one other way that we have a system that, you know, the research on the harms of detention is pretty clear. Detention doesn't do kids any favors either. So if we could get that 42% of kids and find some other way to serve them, I don't know what this is going to look like when we annualize the numbers and we get the detention screening tools in from around the state, but it'll all be, stay tuned, because I'll be sharing it with you. So CSG included this slide, and we just pulled this slide right out of their presentation. Focus on reducing reliance on incarceration has been successful and warranted. So they're making a note here that they know we've done this work. So they're aware that we have been trying to implement everything that came out of Closer to Home 5 years ago. The three early items that they talked about at our meeting, Senator Elkin was at the what, like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, time flies.
3 weeks, yeah.
They did kind of their unveiling of their first overview. And the first thing they said that they thought we should really take a serious hard look at is decoupling our 2720 from the criminal code. Because 2720 describes a delinquent child and says if they did this, and it points directly back to the criminal code in North Dakota. There are many states who have figured out ways to define delinquents that don't so closely tie them to adult offenses. And so that's going to be worth taking a look at. I'm anxious for that day. The other suggestion that they made is that our Uniform Court Act 2720, this is what I referenced when we started talking today, includes all of the options that a court or a judge might consider for abused and neglected kids, as well as unruly kids, as well as delinquent kids. So it's really easy for a kid to just start, as they start having a little bit of interaction with the juvenile court, to just keep moving through the chapter and become delinquent. And so the recommendation is that abuse and neglect should stand separately with its own set of guidelines and principles and interventions from the delinquent kids. So that's sort of their second point. And their third one is that North Dakota is one of the few states that does not have a source of prevention funding that is accessible without being in an agency. And so part of why we get dependent on child welfare, juvenile court, or juvenile corrections for services for kids is because we really haven't organized around that prevention funding that would not be fettered to a specific agency. And so this, I think, is something that you're going to see the cabinet take up as an issue, or perhaps this is what will end up being over in that behavioral health continuum of services. But a way for law enforcement to refer a family to services as opposed to having to cite them to get them into a system to get services, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. So those are sort of the three big things that CSG has pointed out to us so far. And so what we've decided to do then is we're going to begin that conversation at the Juvenile Justice Commission at our next meeting and just start bringing people in from the stakeholder areas, from child welfare, from the juvenile court, from law enforcement, from public defender's offices, to just start talking about the ramifications of these three things, schools, and see what people think about these ideas as policy changes for North Dakota.
Lisa, is there a model that is being used in other states that's more common, like the as far as agency prevention funding? Is it in the Department of Human Services? Is that the model that looks like it the best fit, or is it in the judicial branch or corrections? Or what do you know about where it should be if that is
what I know at this point is they're advocating that it be way up front, that it not be tied into an agency.
Not to any agency,
okay. Just maybe in the forms of grants that some of the youth serving agencies can use to stand up services in communities. Or I don't feel particularly well versed in this yet, but I do feel that he's been very clear that this should not be tied to your formal systems.
Okay, that clears that up.
So that schools can refer and law enforcement and not have to have children be abused or neglected or unruly or delinquent in order to get services to them and their families. 1 minute, if you'll bear with me. You appropriated additional dollars for day treatment in this last biennium. We did start day treatment in the new kind of the home site. With the beginning of this school year, this is the data that is from the first semester. They worked very fast we had been talking with them before session ended, but of course the money wasn't appropriated until the 1st of July, and they had this thing going when school started. So they did a fantastic job. They've served 27 kids in the first semester. They picked what they thought in Mandan were their highest, most at-risk kids. 70% of them are doing better academically. In 81% of the cases, they've managed to engage the families, and every single one of those kids has not been placed out of their home yet. And that's exactly what we want to see out of day treatment. That's exactly what they're supposed to accomplish. They're supposed to engage those families, engage those community providers, and keep those kids in their home schools and communities where it's the best place for them to be. So we'll keep you informed on how that's going. But that's it.
How many students are in the Mandan?
Well, this was 27.
Okay.
And that was high, that's a high school and a middle school group.
Okay. Well, Representative Rohr, you have, it's right in your backyard, you know, you can.
I do have a question.
The cane is going to come out.
No,
and
no, my question was, you mentioned it's going to take a culture shift, because it seems that we want to incarcerate kids right away when something happens. And I think I remember you saying early on that the residential, if a kid goes into a residential facility, that they have a higher recidivism rate and it's not wise for them to be there. So do we have a lot of those kinds of treatment facilities in our state? Should we be closing those?
So what I want to say is, I think if you suggested to law enforcement or schools or the residentials, I think if you suggested that they want to lock kids up, they'd bristle. I don't think that's how they feel. I think they feel they don't, that's where the services are. And so I think that they think, I mean, we talked long and hard in Mandan with the leadership. They firmly believed that getting a kid cited was good for the kid, because the kid was going to get services. And so it's a philosophy that just evolves when all we've funded is just the very back end. Then that's, you know, that's the water hole you go to, right? And so there's two things that will happen, like with that detention. One, the first reaction will be, I have to. I don't have anything else I can do. And so if we don't stand up something else that they can use, it's going to be really hard to change that notion that kids should just go in. And we hear things like, it'll do them good to sit overnight and think about what they did. Well, maybe we could sit someplace else where you don't have to be strip searched, right? Could we do that for kids? Because that's not good for any 13-year-old.
Lisa, as far as the timing.
You got that on your little camera, don't you?
Good.
The recommendation.
Kind of crap you see on the news then. Oh, my God, I said that.
The recommendations will be in ready, and you'll have recommendations for in the next legislative session for these services that, you know, for most of many of us are on appropriations committee, and unfortunately it doesn't line up that, you know, that you can take away from the institutional care and move it to the communities, and everything is a neutral position. There's a time gap here, so there'll be an appropriation that you're going to need for this, I assume.
Well, we'll see where you guys land on all of this, right? I mean, there's always more than one way to solve a problem. And so, I mean, I have full confidence. I mean, Dave and Leanne are as creative people as I've ever met, and they're working with the Moss Group. I think we'll come up with good solutions. I think I just want to make it very clear that we're probably always going to have some capacity for pretty intense kids. I don't know that it's all got to be in one place. I mean, I don't know that. Maybe there's some other ways we can form partnerships someplace else and help them, train them to, you know, stay safe while they're taking care of high-test kids. We'll see what happens in that. That will be up to you. But you will see, I think, through the Interim Judiciary Committee, Representative Clemene is fairly dogged in his aspiration to do something with the juvenile code. I think that will help kids coming upstream, and I'm certain that the cabinet is going to be looking at both what the commission is doing as well as what behavioral health is doing.
Well, I think between all the committees that work on this, we can hopefully make a difference. So
if we get a chance to strengthen, you know, community supervision, case management, services in the community, those are the things that make the biggest impact for the most kids. And this is always a resource game, right? What should we do less of, more of? And so we got to do the best that we can for the kids that we can do something with.
Thank you. Are there any questions, any further questions? Representative Chauvier.
Real quick, Mr. Chairman, Lisa, my question is on that day program. Is that the system you're trying, or the program you're trying to create from the slide before that one, or are those kids already in, quote,
oh,
the system?
Oh, my, I confused you, didn't I? I'm yeah. sorry about that. Day treatment is a program that the Division of Juvenile Services has run in conjunction. It used to be with Department of Human Services and Department of Public Instruction, but we kind of lost that partnership a few years ago when funding kind of moved away. But this is a program we've run for about 30 years. We don't run it in very many sites because we don't have the resources, but I have been so deliberate with it, with the appropriations people, because it's so effective. You saw the data in just one semester. It's just so good. I wish every school could have it, but we've got to find a way to sort of showcase that, and we have to have the schools on board with that, right? They have to be as enthusiastic as we are about the effects of it. But that's not, that's a service, it's not the service. It's one that we're familiar with and we know about and we know works. The numbers are just as good out of intensive in-home. And I would love to have more family workers that could go into families and do work as well.
Thank you. Representative Rowe.
Oh man, I'm trying to go.
Well, you know, you always bring questions.
Mr. Chairman, it's not a question. It's just a comment that we received during the interim Judiciary Committee, a presentation on the intensive in-home services being conducted by the Southeast Human Services. So MST and MST Psych, multi-systemic therapy, and yeah, really, really awesome outcomes because it's filling a gap. So instead of just coming in for maybe 1 to 3 hours and helping a family, 1 to 3 hours a week, or the alternative is out-of-home placement. It's filling in that gap so the kids can stay with the family, can work with the whole family unit and address some of those stressors.
Yep, and that's yep. one in-home model. There's two or three of them. Yep. They're good.
Yep. Any further questions? If not, thank you, Lisa. It's always, you always leave us with a lot of educational.
Thank you.
Okay, next is the pretrial services pilot project.
Just, I need to get this figured out here. There we go. There we go. Okay, my name is Adam Anderson. I'm the pretrial program manager with the Department of Corrections. I want to thank the chairman and the committee for having me here today to talk about pretrial services. I'm going to start out with talking about what pretrial services is. Can everybody hear me okay?
Is the mic on?
The blue light.
Yes, there it
is. Okay, it needs to be blue.
Blue.
You
might pull it up.
A little bigger than, a little taller than you? Okay. As I said, I'm going to start out with talking about what pretrial services is and what our goals are. Challenged with the clicker here. Okay, starting out with our goals are to reduce incarceration. I don't know if you can see the graphic up here. We're looking at how many North Dakota residents are locked up and where they are. We've got 1,400 people approximately locked up in county jails on any particular day. Of those 1,400, the statistics bear out, if we're close to the national statistics, somewhere around 60-64% of those people are in some sort of pretrial status. Some of those people are there because there's holds from other jurisdictions and things like that. We really, there's some things that we can do, especially with in-state people like that, but some of those people we really can't do a lot about, but we can make a difference in this area. Another one of our goals is to reduce criminal activity. What we want to do is we don't want criminal activity when they're on that pretrial period between the time that they see a judge and they're released to the time that their case is adjudicated. And I think that pretrial services can assist in that area. Reduce the failures to appear. Failures to appear occur in different ways. Some people are trying actively to avoid consequences. Some people are just irresponsible. There's some things and some tools that we would use to get those people to court so we're not wasting those law enforcement and court resources trying to chase the people down for their court appearances that they should be going to. So, there we go. Okay, what are our primary functions? First, we're going to collect and analyze defendant information. We're going to be using a risk assessment, an interview process, and then we're going to be verifying the answers that we get through the interview process as well as the answers we get in the risk assessment. Using the information that we glean from the risk assessment and the interview, we're going to compile a pretrial report for the courts so the courts can make an informed bail decision so that when they have somebody standing in front of them, they're not judging them based on the classification of offense that they've been accused of, but they're also getting a look at that person and who that person is, what their history's been like, and what risk they may pose to either fail to appear to the court or fail or to the community. We will give a recommendation as part of that pretrial report as to what we think should happen with that person, but the judge would retain any discretion as far as detain, release, or any kind of financial bond that would be attached to that person's release. And then at the end of the pretrial period, we would be doing a pretrial completion report. The pretrial completion report would be a snapshot of what happened on pretrial. Did that person have any violations or any problems? Did that person work on any of the identified issues that they may have had? So for example, if this person was on a drug offense, and that person acknowledges, I have a drug problem, I need to get help for this, we would be detailing that in our post or our pretrial completion report that yes, this person has looked for services, this person has done, has taken steps to try to take care of the problem on their own prior to the court intervening and sentencing them. And then of course our last primary function is going to be to supervise the defendants. We're going to monitor the release and pretrial conditions. Release and pretrial conditions in the model that I've created are a little bit different. A release condition would be something that the judge has laid out and said, this is an actual condition of your release. If there's a violation of those things, we would be reporting them directly to the court. An example of that would be somebody who's been accused or is a defendant in a case where there's a victim, and there's a victim contact restriction. What we would be doing is we would be monitoring that. If we're aware of any sort of a contact restriction or contact violation, we'd be reporting that directly to the court with a request for court action right away. A pretrial condition would be something that's more along the lines of maintaining employment or something along those lines, things that we can deal with internally at an administrative level and try to help them, put them in touch with the resources they need to take care of that issue. Also, we're going to be connecting them with those community resources. We're going to be assessing and seeing if they need any sorts of treatment, if they feel that they are appropriate for treatment or they're willing to engage those resources. We're going to do everything we can to refer them to the right spots or the right places to get that help. Going hand in hand with that, we're going to promote any needed behavior change. If we have a defendant in there that knows that they need to work on certain areas of their life, where staff will be trained in different methods of communication and motivation to try to help that person to make the needed changes in their life to avoid being put in the position they're in again. And then another big one is reminders for court dates. There I'm talking about the people who have been, that I talked about earlier, who are irresponsible. Somebody who, for instance, maybe has a single parent who has childcare problems, somebody who has transportation issues, things like that. They get a date, and sometimes they're not the most responsible people in the world, and they're not thinking ahead to finding or taking care of all the peripheral things they need to take care of to make it to that court appearance. So what we would be doing is giving them reminders, hey, you have a court appearance next week. Do you have your child care lined up? Do you have the time to take off from work? Do you have transportation to get to and from court? Things like that, so we can try to prepare them and help them to get to that court appearance. Okay, so the importance of pretrial services. We have the presumption of innocence, obviously. These people are defendants in a case. They have not been convicted of anything yet, and they have a right to due process. Chief Justice Rehnquist in 1987 gave us this quote, in our society, liberty is the norm. Detention prior to trial or without trial is a carefully limited exception. So what we're looking at there is, does this person really need to be incarcerated prior to trial? Are there other ways we can ensure that they're going to make it to their court appearances without keeping them incarcerated? And obviously, more benefits to the defendants are retaining their life supports. They're retaining the family connection. their jobs, their housing, their access to resources. And all these things can tend to snowball once they're denied any one of those things. Somebody who's been incarcerated and loses their job, and all of a sudden they can't make their rent payments, they can't make their phone payments. It's more difficult for them to find a job, because if they can't pay for their phone, the job can't get back to them if they're looking for work. So what we're trying to do is keep them in touch with those people rather than having them incarcerated. Benefits to the state. I hope you can see this graphic up here. But first, to make a more informed bail decision for the judges to be able to see that person as who they are and determine their risk based on evidence, not based on some subjective opinion of that person or based on their classification of the offense they've been accused of. Risk reduction. Does financial bond reduce risk? I think in some cases you have to look at that $100,000, $500,000 bond, and is that preventing that person from going to court, or is that going to ensure that court appearance? Is that person is invested in that financial investment as they are in retaining their liberty if they feel that that's going to be taken away from them? Also, you have to look at the does that money reduce the risk to the community for any further victimization or any further crimes? We're talking about people who make impulsive decisions. I don't think they're thinking about that $100,000, $500,000 before they make a decision to, you know, reoffend or, you know, commit a new offense. And back to this graphic, it's fiscally responsible. It's about 1/8 the cost of incarceration. This is a study in 2015 by the U.S. courts. I'm not going to say that the numbers are really going to reflect what it's costing us. It may, but I think what we're looking at there is the relationship between the numbers. That 1/8, it costs much less money to have somebody on pretrial supervision than it does to incarcerate that person. And then also, when you're looking at the law enforcement and court actions that are associated with failures to appear, and the law enforcement having to go out and serve those warrants, and the courts having to issue those warrants and schedule those court times for defendants to just not appear in court. I just had a court case yesterday, and I'm not sure if pretrial services would have helped this guy out or not, but I can tell you we were working with this person from June until yesterday to get him back into court. And I can't even tell, I think I ended up at the courthouse half a dozen times and he failed to appear. So. Benefits to the community. There's family stability, keeping that person in the house, in the family, engaged in the community. They remain in the workforce, so not only are they keeping their job, they're also keeping their employer from having to find somebody to fill in for them or to replace them at their place of employment. And again, it's less strain on the court and law enforcement resources. Now on to the progress we've made so far. We started this in July. We had our site selected in September. We selected the North Central Judicial District, the South Central Judicial District, and the East Central Judicial Districts from five that had expressed interest. We put together pretrial work groups consisting of a judge, prosecutor, defense counsel, sheriff, jail administration, court administration, victim services, and parole and probation, because we felt like all those factions had some say in what should happen here. They had all had some interest in what the outcome of this pretrial services pilot was going to be. So from there, using the input that I received from those work groups and also input from these organizations, the National Association of Pretrial Service Agencies, the National Institute of Corrections, those regional work groups I talked about, North Dakota Association of Counties has been involved, ACLU has been involved, NDSU has been helping us with how we're going to gather our data and how we're going to get that data analyzed so we can bring it back to the legislature next session. And then with the DOCR, I've drawn a lot of support from the organization I work with. I forgot one of the people, or one of the organizations that's been really helpful is the Federal Pretrial Services. We're working on getting upgrades to our client management system that's called DocStar so that we can accommodate those pretrial services defendants. We're working on finding ways to automate notifications so that we don't have people picking up the phone and sending text messages manually, so that we can get access to a data stream and build some sort of a system where we can automatically send out notifications if there is a change in a court date or something along those lines, or just to let them know ahead of time, hey, you have court next week, maybe you should find somebody to take care of your kids, maybe you should get time off from work so you don't have a problem later on. So, and then we've been working on getting defense counsel to be present at these initial appearances and these bond hearings, because it's one of the essential elements that the NIC has laid out for effective pretrial services program, is they want to see meaningful defense or meaningful counsel at that initial appearance. I think there's an adversarial action that's occurring at that time if a person's liberty is at risk, and I think that they deserve to be defended by a knowledgeable counsel. We're working with the North Dakota Commission on Legal Counsel for Indigents and Travis Fink to craft some language to either change a rule or to change policy to make that easier, make that work out for us. That's my presentation today. Again, this is my contact information. If anybody has any questions later on that they think about and they want to give me a call or contact me, I'd be happy to talk to them then. Or if you have questions now, I'd be happy to address them.
Senator Mathern has one.
Mr. Chairman and sir, you know, during the session when we authorized the program, it just seems so obvious after the data was given to us that everybody would want to do this. And now I see this further data, and it's like, why doesn't everybody just do this? What is the barrier? I mean, why did we have a pilot program and now this information? What prevents judicial districts just to go ahead and do this without any state intervention?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mathern, my opinion is that it's such a departure from what we've traditionally done. I think we're very, historically, we've been very handcuffed to this financial bail system. And it's, and I'm not willing to say that we should abolish that completely, but what I'm saying is there's different ways to do things. And I think you're right. I think it's pretty obvious. And if you look around the country, there's been a really strong push with pretrial services, and being involved in that and having North Dakota involved with that has really opened some eyes around the country with some of the national organizations I'm talking about. I've received a lot of support from those people because they're really excited about what we're doing here.
So it's just a resistance to change, you know. Maybe.
You're preaching to the choir. I agree with you 100%. The more I've gotten involved in this, the more I've thought this just makes sense. Why haven't we been doing this before?
Representative Rohr.
Thank you, Chairman. So based on this pilot, you've demonstrated the counties that you're providing this service. Does everyone get pre-trial services, or do you do an assessment and determine who goes into that program?
Because this is a pilot program, we wanted to take a cross-section, a random cross-section, so that if we do choose to target certain population groups, we can do that in the future. Mm-hmm. But for now, it's completely randomized. We're going by days of the week in different locations. So, for example, on a Tuesday in Cass County, we would offer pretrial services to every defendant coming through that meets the criteria. Some of those criteria are, do they reside in a pretrial district? Do they have, are they on parole or probation currently? And just there's some different things that we set out to narrow the field down a little bit, just so that we can get a better, a more pure data sample is the way I would put it. So, like for instance, one of the things that we wanted to avoid is taking, taking actions on old cases, because if we're looking at a group of defendants there have already demonstrated some level of noncompliance, and I was concerned about how that may affect our data sample coming back. So to answer your question, we're completely randomizing it, and hopefully the data will assist us in determining how we're going to move forward with this.
Continue.
So you've been doing this for 7 months. So what is your N right now? What is your population, or how many do you have?
We have not started. We haven't. Our funding for our staff that will actually be doing this. Doesn't start until July 1st, from what I understand.
Adam, one of the bullets that I thought would be part of this, and maybe it's my mistake that it's not, that I misunderstood this, but was the access to treatment, and whether it's behavioral health or addiction treatment. It wasn't that part of this this program?
Right. That's where I'm going back to. I may have glossed over that a little bit, and I apologize for that. The access to services and service referrals, using Freedom to Recovery, using the resources that are available in the community through different different avenues, whether it's through DHS or through private providers and things like that, to get the defendants in touch with those resources that they may need.
Okay, that's, I think that's important to know.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Any other Representative Shelby here?
Adam, you mentioned the courts and law enforcement and defense attorneys. Before we even get going on this, are you getting any pushback from any of those folks? Or are they all pretty excited to see this happen in the areas where we have the start, I guess?
I have received no significant pushback from anywhere. There's been some good debate about the how we're going to do it, but as far as the value of the program, I've received nothing but support so far.
Any further, Representative Hansen? I'm sorry, I called you Rose last night.
It's totally fine. Call me anything. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, so the first year of the biennium is designing the program. Then starting in July, as you said, you'll start actually conducting it. When we convene as a legislature in January 2021, it will really only have been in action for half a year. What are some of the metrics that you think that you'll have for us as a body when we get together next January so that we can assess the next step?
I have to be honest with you, I don't know what our sample size is going to be at that point. We're looking at 6 months between now and then. I need to try to determine what an appropriate caseload size is so that we can determine what types of numbers we're going to bring back. Like you said, it is a concern that we're only going to have 6 months before you convene again. So what we want to do is we want to launch immediately on July 1st. We've taken steps so that we can get our staff hired and get them ready and trained and ready to hit the ground running when we start July 1st. And beyond that, I can just tell you that I'm hoping I have enough numbers to give you a significant report as to what we've been doing and what kind of differences we've been making.
Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Adam, I see that two of your practice sites are contain Standing Rock and MHA. Is that any discussion going on? I mean, they're separate governments. They have separate judicial, separate everything.
Yes.
But also the borders of those two reservations do not necessarily always stop at the border. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I have Representative Holman and Chairman, I have reached out to Standing Rock and I've made a trip down there to visit with tribal probation. We have their support. They've expressed a desire to help us with different things. As the program's developed, I have not been back down there recently and I have not been to Fort Berthold yet, but it has been a concern and it has been something that we've talked about within the work groups.
Representative Rohr.
Thank you, Chairman. So is that why on your pie chart you mentioned that there's 4,500 North Dakota residents, but you only accounted for 4,490? So there's 10 missing.
Excuse me?
On your pie chart, there's 10 missing on your population that you've accounted
for. The
very
first one?
This one here.
Oh, okay.
So when you add these up, you get 4,590.
Okay.
But your population up here is 4,500. So I'm just curious what happened to the 10. I thought maybe it had to do with the border issue.
I wasn't aware of that.
Okay.
Thank you for pointing that out.
We call that decimal dust. There's no further questions. Adam, I appreciate your presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to comments by interested persons. So if you have any thoughts on what you've heard today and what's been taking place since our last meeting, now's your time. Don't be afraid. We're harmless. If not, then let's move on to committee discussion and staff directives. Committee, what are we looking for before we meet again? I guess that Leanne, maybe can you tell us what we're the next meeting, how the Moss group and their work, where will we be when we before we set our next meeting date?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we have to get in hold of the Moss group yet and see where they're going to be in their work, but we haven't. We don't have a time frame right now.
Okay. Well, until we get that information, right. We're not going to schedule anything.
No.
But I would assume that we'll be getting, into the second quarter of the year to finish our work. Do you feel we're on track to have the recommendations?
I believe we are. Our goal is to have the Moss information by late July, early August.
Okay.
So,
Senator Mather?
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, and Leanne, are any of the changes that Lisa Burgard discussed in terms of Century Code, are any of those changes being made by another committee, or do you believe those things should go through this committee?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Mather, I believe not this committee. Okay. There's another plenty of group going on for juvenile justice. It shouldn't be this committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I would think that the judiciary committee would if there's any interim bills that would come out, it should come out of that committee. But
right.
And I don't know if it's necessary that an interim bill needs to come out of this interim. That's something that I haven't had that conversation with Chairman Kameen. No, that's a good point.
Mr. Chairman, the juvenile justice study was assigned to the interim judiciary committee. But should we run out of meetings, the Commission on Juvenile Justice could also bring forward a draft bill in January, or an individual could. So it's definitely being covered.
Okay, I think that's the important part. I don't think it has. We have jurisdiction in this, and we have not enough information in this committee to make a recommendation. Is there anything further that the committee, Representative Schobinger?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding the New England situation will probably be a big part of that study recommendation. Is it our plan as a committee to go take a look at that facility, or can we do that individually? I've not been there, and that's one of the places I think before I make a decision on that, irregardless of what the Moss group says, that I'd like to go take a look at, whether it's individually or as a committee.
What are we looking at? One or two more meetings?
Yeah. I think the thought process is that we would hold a meeting in New England. Whether it's the next one or not, I don't know yet. I would guess that if the Moss group has a presentation for us, that would probably be better served to have in Bismarck, I think we do intend to hold a meeting in New England as well. It's that road is a two-lane road. It does run from Fargo to New England too, by the way.
Well, I think the sooner we do it, the better. I think that's a key ingredient, and I'm glad Senator, Representative Schobinger brought it up. You got to be going down there as soon as possible.
We will note that, and maybe that'll be a discussion that our next meeting could possibly be in New England, if depending on the timing. If we're looking at August for the Moss Group to complete their work, we could probably do that prior to that. Any further discussion? If not, I think what we'll do is we'll adjourn this meeting, and then as many of you know, the tour of the state penitentiary begins at 12:30, and what we will do is, I think we're responsible for our own transportation out there. Leanne, do you want to give us where you want us to meet, or where, how the directions for those that haven't been there before?
Mr. Chairman, everybody knows where the Penn's at, correct? In terms of just going on Railroad Avenue, and you can just park in the main parking lot out front. There should be space available, and we'll make sure that we have cars moved.
Okay, so just go down Main Avenue to Railroad.
Yeah, Main 26th Railroad.
Yep. If anybody has any questions, we can maybe caravan this.
And just enter through the administration building, that front
yes,
entrance?
Yes, please. Yep.
Everybody's clear with that? And there's nothing else, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Thank you for attending.